Hey there, welcome to Ghost Notes, the podcast where we talk about music inside and out. My name is Noah, but you probably know me better as Polyphonic.
And I'm Corey, and you probably know me as 12 Tone. And today we're going to ask the question, do we listen to too much music?
Yes.
So
the answer is
I guess
yes.
We're not done talking about Spotify?
Yeah.
Is that what's going on?
A little bit. There's a bit of Spotify here. There's a bit of, you know, so I'll give you the whole sort of context to this. So as we are recording this, I am just recently got back from a couple months of travel on my hiatus, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking. And
to be fair, I did ask, but before we started
recording.
Yeah, record,
I know.
Yeah.
I was saying that to the audience. The audience didn't ask.
I just want credit.
Yeah. But yeah, I had really, really lovely travels. But it was interesting because one of the things that was sort of in the back of my mind, you know, before I went on the travels, because I have eternal content brain, is like, hey, maybe I can, you know, like make a video out of, I don't know, like whatever songs I listened to on travels or what I learned about music on travels. And, you know, there were definitely some things that I picked up. You know, I spent a day with my good friend in Australia doing Australia's Hottest 100 Day, which is apparently a big Australian cultural tradition talking about music. I listened to music on, you know, a couple road trips. I saw some live music too. But by and large, I like really, really did not spend that much time on the trip listening to music. And, you know, I think one of the things that I found that was really sort of interesting or exciting or just something that sort of I probed into a little is that I thought it was really nice to spend a lot of time not listening to music. And it wasn't because I have suddenly learned to hate music, because I've always hated music, as anyone who would listen to this
knows. Music is bad.
Yes. But I think it sort of made me step back and take a look at how sort of completely, you know, 24/7 surrounded by music we are in the modern age. And it made me wonder if there's a degree to which that kind of cheapens things, you know, because for me, when I hadn't really actively listened to a song in 2 or 3 days, and then I walk by, you know, I was in Wellington in New Zealand, and there was this awesome street performers, this quintet of like jazz quintet of like 20-year-olds who are just doing this awesome street performance. And I was like, oh, shit, this is really good. Like, you know, like this sounds really, really fantastic. And I feel like it made me tune in a little bit more to the music that I did hear. And I also found that when I was spending less time listening to music, I was spending a lot more time thinking about the music that I did hear. And, you know, in times where I'm just walking around a city, these thoughts are kind of going through my mind where once I might have, you know, walked around with headphones in listening to that music, but now I, you know, I'll hear a song and it'll sort of sit and ruminate with me. So that's sort of the impetus for everything that, you know, I'm talking about here. But I think sort of, you know, do we listen to too much music is the clickbaity thing that will name the title to get you looped in.
Probably.
But as I said to Corey when we planned this, I think really the question that I really want to ask here is sort of how has the availability of music changed our relationship to music? Because I don't really like adding, you know, qualitative, the opposite.
No, well, quantitative either, but
yes.
Yeah.
I don't like adding qualitative judgment statements on, oh, you should listen to this amount of music or you are listening to too much music.
Yeah.
But I do think we're sort of at an interesting point where for most of human history, the only way you could listen to music was live, right?
Yes. I'm going to push back on you a little bit there.
Okay.
Because I think one important factor is that, like, in the pre-recording era, like, this is a role that folk music played a lot of the time, where people's lives were very much inundated with music through things like work songs or sea shanties or, you know, children's lullabies or hymns at church. Like all of these, it wasn't necessarily that you couldn't get music most of the time. You're right, the only way you could experience it was live, but human beings, human bodies are walking instruments.
Yes.
Inherently. And so anytime you are near a person, which you always are, bad news about you being a person. But anytime you're near a person, music can happen. And
yes,
I think that a lot of what's changed is, I guess, the passivity of that, right? Like, if I'm like hauling like a rope on a ship and we're singing Drunken Sailor, I'm singing along, I'm participating, or at least I'm pulling a rope in time, but I'm in a communal activity. Whereas if I'm walking down the street with my headphones on, listening to Great Big Sea sing Drunken Sailor, did they do that? They probably did. I feel like they did.
I'm sure they've done it. I don't know if there was a, there's an official recording of it, but I feel like
they've done it live. I'm sure.
Yes.
But yeah, that sort of thing, then it's more passive, but it's still, it's not that I didn't have access to it prior. It's that I didn't have access to that sort of, again, more passive engagement. I had to be a bit more participatory.
So maybe another way of putting it, then maybe that music needed to be live is a poor phrasing. Maybe what I'm trying to say is that for most of human history, it was basically impossible to listen to music privately.
Yes.
You could not listen to music on your own unless you were creating music.
Yes, unless you were on your own.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I guess you could like listen to it from the next room over if you were quiet or something like that. But like broadly, we get the point. And I think that that's one of the big things that I've started thinking about with this is when the only way that you get to engage with music is through your interactions with other people, it makes music a much stronger communal experience.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that I think has been lost a little in this shift. And that's not to say music isn't still an enormous communal experience. There is a lot of communal experience around music. Half my friendships are built around, you know, listening to music together or talking about music together. But I do think that there is, I can't even really put my finger on what it is, but I think there is something lost in the way that it is possible for me to just hole up, not experience any sort of human interaction and, you know, listen to tons of music.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hesitant on the word lost. And again, I'm sort of poking holes in like wording.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you look at something like the Eras Tour. I know people who lost their goddamn minds trying to get tickets to the Eras Tour.
Yes.
Like the idea of being engaging with music in a communal space is not necessarily something that becomes unappealing once you start having it in a private space as well. Like people who really wanted to go see Taylor Swift in concert are also people who listen to Taylor Swift's records. Records? Albums? You know what I mean.
Yeah, it's an industry term.
Yes. Yeah, these are people who listen to these albums and to these songs on repeat a bunch anyway, and like they're also doing it. And so it's one of those things where like instinctively I always want to be careful about implying that the creation of a new way to engage with art is killing an old way. And that's not to say that it's not true. It's just, I think that you can do both. You can be interested in both. And that's not to say that you're not changing your relationship.
I also think maybe a better way of putting it is I think that there is something lost, something gained here.
Yes.
Right? And this is why I was sort of hesitant to frame it in the clickbaity way, but we are content creators. We got to do what we got to do.
Got to get them clicks.
But I think that's one of the big things for me is that I think there's a lot gained from people being able to listen to music everywhere all of the time. But I also think that there is a loss in the fact that, you know, people still do go out and dance and club and stuff like that. But the culture around this stuff, I mean, this is Ghost Note, so I'm lamenting the loss of folk song as per usual.
Playing the hits.
Yeah, exactly. But there is something there for me where I do feel like it's part of a kind of like general trend in contemporary society is the increase in catering to the individual, which breaks down networks of community support and solidarity.
Yeah.
And I think music is one of the ways that that sort of manifests.
Yeah.
Where I think people used to go out and talk to strangers more because they would play music with strangers or sing with strangers, you know, or there's all of these things that have sort of shifted to the realm of, well, I don't need to go out and play music with a stranger because I can sit at home and listen to music. And again, I feel like I'm sounding like a grumpy old man here.
Yeah.
I just want to stress, I don't think this is a catastrophic issue, but I think it's interesting and worth talking about.
Yeah. And it's also like not universal, like, right? Like there are still people who go to clubs all the time. There are still like jazz jam sessions that happen all the time in every major city on earth.
I think one of the big things that has happened is that these sorts of things have become more and more the realm of subcultures and musician subcultures, where they once used to be part of daily life.
Yes. Yes. That I think I would agree is a change that we have seen. And the other big change that I think is relevant in this point is that, like, I don't think necessarily that music has become significantly more available, but I think professional music has.
Yes.
Right?
Like, that's a great way of putting it.
This is a thing where, like, back in the day, if I wanted to hear the greatest singers in the world, or even like the greatest singers in my city, I would have to like find a show they were doing. I'm talking with modern terms, but like this has to be pre-recording technology. So this is 19th century. I don't know if they were doing shows back then. Just, you know, check out the latest opera gig. But like, yeah, the go see a performance. And that was an expense. It was an event. It was a thing that, but like, you know, and I could wander around for the next month singing the songs that I had heard or singing other songs that I like. But like these days, if I want to hear my favorite singer, they're on YouTube. Like their albums are on YouTube. Their songs are on Spotify. Like it's so easy. And so much more of my music consumption is relegated to this world of people who are in the professional class of musician, as opposed to people who are just people.
And I think, like I've been saying, like it's a double-edged sword there, where I also think there's a lot of enrichment from your average music listener has listened to more different music than, you know, ever before in human history. Like, not even close, not even like a like big music fan, like just your average person today has listened to a greater diversity of music than really like anybody in human history.
Yeah. Than Beethoven.
Which is really cool. But I think one of the things that I find interesting is the idea that you look at how, you know, historical writings of how people have been moved by music, and when it has such a greater level of novelty, the impact on people is, it's a different sort of hit. It's like, you know, there are writings of people, many documentations along across different like nations and cultures of stuff, of people going to art galleries and like falling on their knees and openly weeping at the art because they had never seen something that stimulated them like this, right? Yeah. And I think that that's a human experience that is lost.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, lost is a strong word, but yeah. But I know what you mean.
Yeah, that is made more rare, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but it's made more rare, but the point was always that it was rare, right? Like, if I'm going to an art museum every week and, like, weeping at the beauty, that starts to lose its novelty pretty quickly.
Yes.
But, like, drawing this coincidentally, recently had an experience where I put on this thing I often do where I just like I'll see an album recommended to me on YouTube and I'll be like, sure, let's check that out. And I was doing that and I got to a song that was so good I had a panic attack. Like,
oh yeah.
Really, like this was like 2 weeks ago. Very recent experience.
What was the song?
It was Sold Soul's cover of Mr. Crowley.
Oh, cool.
Off their album I Hope We Make It Out of Here Alive. I didn't see it coming. It was so good. Like, I've really been enjoying the album. It's a really good album. It's not for everyone. It's deathcore. But it was exactly what I was looking for in that moment. The album as a whole was great. And then it ended with a cover of Mr. Crowley that, like, I literally, like, I stopped what I was doing and just sat there with my mouth open and just, like, feeling so many emotions. And that's, like, also in addition to the thing itself, like, I have a personal connection to that song. I did Mr. Crowley in the final showcase for my associate's degree, which I shouldn't have done. It was not in my range. I am not a baritone. I am not a tenor. I probably should have lowered the key, but that's neither here nor there. Point is, I have an attachment to that song, and it came on, and it just blew me completely away. And, like, that's a thing that I found, again, through exactly this experience of just having so much music freely available. So, like, again, this is not to, like, take away from your point. I think that it is still a fundamental shift. But I think that sort of thing can still happen.
I agree with you.
Yeah. One thing about it that I think is also noteworthy in, like, what you were talking about in terms of looking back at not necessarily how people react to art, but how people, like, historical records and writing about art.
Yeah.
And I think in that context, an important thing to consider is, again, this shift towards privacy, where yes. If we hadn't been doing this episode of this show, like, a couple weeks after, no one but me would ever have known that I had that yeah. experience. I considered tweeting about it, posting on Blue Sky, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I considered posting about it. I decided not to. I decided to just let that be a private experience that I had had. And that means that if you look at the historical record of this period, it looks like that event didn't happen. Because up until now, there is no record of it. And I think that maybe this is a hypothesis. This is not something that I have any concrete data on. But maybe at least part of why we're seeing less of that is, again, that shift towards privacy and that shift toward having, like, more personal experiences that aren't witnessed by other people, and so they don't get recorded.
Well, and I do also wonder, like, it also would not surprise me in the least bit if a lot of these experiences that happened in public are dramatized, you know,
yeah, or like to some degree, like, performative.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I don't doubt that the reactions are real, but I also think yeah. humans behave differently in public to private, especially when it comes yeah. to emotions. Like, there are, you know, movies that I will in private, like, watch and think, oh, that's pretty funny, and never laugh out loud with, but then watch with yeah. a friend and be busting a gut the whole time. Like, yeah. people are different in different situations, believe it or not. No. Wild.
But, no. But yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I think we can kind of move on in this conversation from that point, because I think yeah. that there's one degree of comparing, you know, broadly the sort of 20th and 21st century music listening to pre-recording. You can kind of divide it there. But then yeah. I think there's another divide that doesn't have as clear of a line. You know, if we want to put a line at it, I would almost say between 20th and 21st century listening.
Yeah, we'll call it the Napster line.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the Napster line, like, there's another shift that happens there in the way that yeah. people listen to music. And the thing is, we were getting closer and closer to it with, like, yeah. you know, Walkmans and iTunes. And I guess iTunes came sort of after Napster. But we were basically ever since, even before recording technology, there's been a desire for people to be able to listen to music on their own. Like, that's
yeah.
music boxes, player pianos, you know, these devices have existed because it's a exciting prospect.
Yeah.
But really, like, you know, the 20th century introduces recording and suddenly people can listen to this stuff in their household and stuff like that. But the big dividing line, I think, is two things. One, the degrees of portability, like, with the MP3 are just way, way greater than mm-hmm. even with a Discman or a Walkman yeah. or something like that, because you still functionally need to carry a thing full of cassettes,
yeah.
which is unwieldy. And the other thing, too, is just the sheer breadth of music that people suddenly had access to was wholly unprecedented, where before it was your collection, and then suddenly it was the entirety of all music humans had recorded, basically,
yeah.
Pretty quickly. Like, not actually the entirety, but, well, you know, yeah. one statistical deviation away from the entirety.
Yeah. Enough that it feels like the entirety.
Yes. Enough that you could not functionally listen in your lifetime to all of the music that you have access to right now.
Yes.
It would be impossible.
Yeah.
It would be impossible for 100 lifetimes to do it right now.
Yeah. And there's conversations to be had about, like, what specifically gets left out of that entirety. And that's its own set of questions. I don't think that's super relevant to this particular conversation, but I do want to acknowledge it, that like it's not a random sampling.
Yes.
There are clear biases in the data set vis-a-vis what you are most likely to have access to, and those shape what you listen to.
Yes.
Even if you are going out of your way to find more obscure stuff.
Yeah, there are big biases as to, you know, what... You basically said it as well as I can. But yeah, so this is sort of where we enter the Noah gets mad at Spotify portion of the episode.
Gotta play the hits.
Yes, exactly. where I think that one of the things that has happened with this sort of vast network of, you know, being able to look at everything is I think that there's been kind of a overstimulation that happens from people being able to listen to everything all the time. There's, you know, a really sort of well-documented or getting increasingly better documented phenomenon that has happened in the last 10 years or so, which is sort of the complete and utter disillusion of our attention spans.
Yeah.
This is stuff that is being studied as we speak by people who are way smarter than me and no ways of measuring this. But one of the big things is that our attention spans are like absolutely being stolen by recommendations algorithm and tech, big tech, and these sorts of things. Like, I think it's really interesting where it plays into music too, because again, this sort of shift of lack of attention span really starts to change the sorts of music that people listen to as well, right? Yeah. When there is all of the music available all of the time, one of the things that happens, it's not necessarily that people are listening to short songs because their attention span is less. There is probably a bit of a degree of that, but I don't really think that that's the issue. But I think the issue is that people lose the ability to just sit and listen to music exclusively, right?
Yeah.
I used to be able to sit and listen to music. I find it incredibly difficult to sit and listen to music with nothing else going on. I'm almost always, anytime I'm listening to music, I'm playing a game or I am driving or I'm hanging out with friends or I'm making art or I'm doing something as I listen to music. And that is a shift that I personally know has happened in my lifetime because when I was a teenager, used to just lie on the floor and listen to music in the dark all the time. And I find that so, so difficult to do now.
Yeah, I have that as well. I think we've talked about this before. But like one asterisk that I do want to throw on there, because apparently that's the role I've decided to take in this particular episode, is just throwing asterisks everywhere.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
But like a lot of my experience with not really being able to just listen to a piece of music with my full attention comes from being a trained professional vocalist and then a professional music theorist and a professional music analyst and having parts of my brain that when I am are like just so trained and so sharpened to when I am listening to music with my full attention that this is practice mode or this is analysis mode. And like I have those. And so why I'm playing a game while I'm doing that is to shut up those parts of my brain so that I can focus on just listening to the music. And so I am not entirely sure how our experience generalizes in that sort of space, because you and I do both have interminable content brain and we are like picking out things that aren't necessarily how other people. So it's another factor that is also probably shaping you and I in this specific context that is worth being careful how well it generalizes.
I think that's a good point. I also do think, and I could be wrong on this, I do think if you asked a lot of people, I think more people these days would say they do something else while listening to music.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
Again, there's nothing wrong with that. I do it, I'm trying to do it less because I think one of the things that happens is that it cheapens the experience of music sometimes, or you miss some of the depth of the music, which is fine. You don't need to do deep listening every time, but I do think there's a lot of value to deep listening.
Yeah.
And I think that it can really enrich yourself. And I think that that's something that the more people struggle with just sitting and listening to music, the less deep listening is done, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, this is, again, coming back to, like, you know, having a relatively unique perspective. I know when I am playing a game while listening to music, I am listening more deeply than I am if I'm just sitting there with headphones most of the time. Like, unless I'm in full analyst mode. Like, if I'm, like, transcribing a song, if I'm, like, trying to, like, make a video about a song and I'm listening to it fully focused in that context, yeah, I'm listening very deeply. But, like, if I'm just putting on an album for fun, I find that I get much more distracted if I am not doing anything else than if I am, and that I'm much more able to engage with the music on its own terms, mostly if I have something visual to look at to distract that portion of my brain. And again, like, I don't want to overgeneralize. You and I, again, are bringing very unique perspectives because we are professional music analysis content creators, and that is not most people's experience of any of this.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is true. I had another point, and I completely forget what it was. It's very good, and everyone listening to this should be like, dang, wow, how did Corey get so insightful?
I also had another point that was lost. A little peek behind the curtain for you all. This is the first episode we've recorded in several months, so if it feels like the first episode we've recorded in several months, that's because it is.
Weird coincidence.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think the other thing with deep listening, though, is that, like you say, it's not the only way to engage with music.
Yes.
And I don't think it's necessarily the only way you should engage with music. I think that it's easy to talk about deep listening as if it is the better way.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a lot of value in shallow listening.
Yes.
I don't know if that's, I'm going to use that because it's this antonym to deep, but like,
the phrase that I'm going to use is vibing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of value in vibing too.
Yeah. I often, when I'm talking about analysis, we'll call it naive listening, where you're not trying to get anything out of it, you're just experiencing it.
I think this is what I was going to say, is that when music is more readily available through streaming and stuff like that, I think that what happens, though, is it's not that I think people should always be deep listening, but I think that it is a skill that enriches people both personally and musically, and I think it's a skill that disappears. And I think one of the places where I think people often do the deepest listening, or at least in my mind, you know, what deep listening is nebulous. Because to be clear, maybe we should step back and ghost notes a little here. When I talk about deep listening, I'm not necessarily talking about like listening for theoretical analysis or lyrical analysis or anything like that. That can be deep listening. But what I mean is sort of, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting metaphysical about this, but just sort of fully subsuming your attention toward the music, however that might be. I think for a lot of people, deep listening can and often does involve like dancing to the music, which, you know, whether that counts as music or not is actually, there's a lot of people that would say dancing is part of music. So I'm fine with considering dancing to music like part of the listening experience, different than like playing video games to music, you know?
Yeah. Well, what if I synchronize my attacks in the video game?
Then you're playing Guitar Hero.
Okay. Guitar Zelda.
So I think that when there is less music available, people are more inclined to deep listen, whatever that means, to the music that they do encounter.
Yeah.
You know, I think there is a much more, at least I have personally found for me, kind of after my travels, not listening to much music. And anytime I did have music on the travels, it really hit me in a different way. Now, another kind of confounding factor here might be that when I was listening to music on the travels, I had also fully turned off work brain, as we talked about. So that's also something. But yeah, I think personally, my experience, and I don't think streaming was a mistake. I think streaming has brought incredible, incredible things to me, to music, to everyone. I think, you know, we've got issues with platforms and stuff like that. We've talked about them lots.
No, I love platforms. Platforms are my favorite. I think there should be more platforms.
Yeah. And I think this is sort of one of the things that's got me tied up in this question in the first place is just, I feel like we talked about this in our Spotify episode a little, but there is a sort of contentification of music, very technical word there, that happens when all of our music is about, you know, all of our musical culture and all of our approaches are about how much music we listen to and how can we listen to more music. And I think one of the things that scares me that I see, and one of the reasons why I ask this question, is I do see more contentification into music. And I, again, there's lots of factors playing into that, but I do think the ready availability of music is one of the driving factors behind that.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think it's a pendulum. Like, I think that you're probably right that at this moment we are at a point where there is a lot of emphasis on music as content, music as data, and listening to as much music as possible, kind of indiscriminately. I expect to see a swing back towards more boutique style engagement with music, looking for more curation, more human input. I don't see this continuing forever in that direction. But I also, like, a thing, this speaks to sort of your point earlier about how it's not necessarily just that something was lost, but more that things are different.
Yes.
Is that I think on the one hand, I agree that if I'm not experiencing as much music, I have more incentive to engage more deeply with any particular piece of music I do encounter. I also think that having access to more music and listening to more music gives me a broader ability to find the music that really truly speaks to me at a level that is worth deeply listening to and getting the stuff that really means something to me. And that's a lot easier to find if I have more access to music.
I think that's a really interesting question, sort of that brings up a really interesting question that I don't really know the answer to, because maybe one of my hotter musical takes is that I don't know how much I really believe in an individual taste. Like, obviously there is individual taste, but I believe tastes can be very easily changed. And I think tastes are a reflection of cultural circumstance often. So I do wonder if one of, and again, this is just pure speculation, but it does make me wonder if one of the reasons why there is so much variance in music taste in the modern age is because there's so much more accessibility to what music is, because people aren't operating on the same sort of small scale communal framework, which, again, that's not something that I have a value judgment on one way or another. I think if anything, I think it's probably good that there's more wide tastes, because, you know, diversity is part of the joy of the human experience.
Yeah. And I also, like, this is one of those questions that, like, sounds insightful, like mine, not yours, but sounds insightful, but actually kind of doesn't mean anything, but is also, I think, important to ask anyway, is like, is it true that there are more diverse tastes now? Or is it true that there are more ways to express pre-existing diverse tastes?
Yeah.
Is it true that Mozart would not have enjoyed deathcore? I don't know. Analogous music did not exist. He had no way of finding out whether or not that was something that spoke to him.
Yeah.
I think I agree with you that a lot of that is culturally informed. Like, I think it is certainly not true that I was born a human being who likes deathcore.
Yeah.
Or even born someone who was going to become that. That had a lot to do with having access to certain kinds of music at certain points in my life that were formational, and then leading me to this point where this is now what I'm listening to. And it's not all I listen to. I listen to a lot of music. I've just been listening to a lot of deathcore recently. But
I mean, I also think something that's relevant here, that this is, as per usual, we're really back to our old bags of tricks. This is a whole other can of worms. But I think one of the things that I also believe and will stand by is that if you take a broad look perspective, there actually aren't even that big differences between even like deathcore and top 40 pop. You know, like a lot of these things are still using the same harmonic frameworks, using a lot of the same song structures, things like this.
Yeah.
They're different enough.
There are reasons you might like one and not the other.
Yes.
But
yeah. But I also don't think it is the dramatic difference that it might seem at first blush.
Sure.
But that's neither really here nor there for the conversation.
Yeah.
That's just me spitting hot takes.
I think it feels correct to me to say that there is a broader difference between the types of music that I can get relatively easily on YouTube right now or Spotify.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Than what someone in the late 18th century.
Yes.
I'm just going to say late 18th century Europe. I think this is probably true of any particular place in the late 18th century. But if you could travel the entire world at that point, that's very unlikely. That probably wasn't true for most people. I say probably it wasn't true for most people. I'm just going to own that. But also, you could encounter a fairly diverse collection of types of music. But a lot of that is still stuff that I could get on YouTube now. So,
well, and I think one of the interesting things, too, and this is a point against the whole do we listen to too much music, is I think there is much more diversity in, you know, like after the Napster line than before the Napster line in, you know, sort of popular music. Right. Yeah. Like I literally earlier today listened to a cover of Hozier's Take Me to Church that was using like Gregorian chant. And it's like before the Napster line, you really weren't getting these sorts of cultural mashups, right? Like there's been a disillusion. And I think that that disillusion is something that has fully, fully positively come from people listening to more and more music.
Yeah, I'm going to throw out the Weird Al Polka remixes as Polka medleys as a counterexample.
Yes.
But like that was Weird Al. That cultural institution, Weird Albert. Like
he was literally named Weird. It wasn't called normal, easily accessible Al.
Yeah, broadly speaking, I completely agree. Yeah. This is not to say that no one was doing like songs in other styles or like playing around with like cultural signifiers and mashups in that sort of way prior to the early 2000s.
Yeah.
It is certainly to say that that stuff has become much more common.
I think music, popular music generally, is becoming more, I think the word I would use for it is cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
Right? Where I don't necessarily think it is becoming more diverse. I think it's often still working in the same frames, but what is being accepted into that framework is pulling from a broader and broader net, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think what it's becoming for me is more fractured, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of it is that there are just so many ways to do music. And I think a lot of that comes from it being a lot easier for an audience to find an artist and, importantly, an artist to find an audience, right? Like, this is not to say that it's super easy to be a professional musician right now.
Yeah.
Extremely not. But
it's easier than ever to be an amateur musician.
Yeah, it's easier than ever to be an amateur musician that people listen to.
Yes.
Like, you can put stuff out there and you can find people who will listen to your stuff. Whether or not that supports you professionally, But, you know, you couldn't have had 100 gecs in the 60s. You were like 15 gecs maximum.
Weirdly, you could have had them in the 1400s, though, but that was just a strange blip.
It was a weird fluke of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as we're sort of reaching toward the end here, as expected, sort of the answer to this question is no, I don't think we listen to too much music, but I think it's an interesting exercise. And it's, I think one of the big things is it's so, so easy to take for granted how much music we have access to.
Yeah.
And it's really worth sort of inspecting how that's changed things, because it certainly has changed things. There's certainly been huge cultural shifts. Some I would say are positive. Some I do think are negative, but that's just change. That's just the way that change works, is things change.
No, things only change when the Fire Nation attacks.
That is true.
Yeah.
I think one of the other impetuses behind this thought exercise was almost sort of like, what is one of the most sort of blasphemous music takes that you can possibly have, right? And I didn't necessarily want to say that outright off the top, because I do think, I think there's something there. I think it's worth discussing, but I do think it's a little fun and interesting to be like, this is the whole point of what we do on this show, is to ask weird questions about music. Yeah. And I do think it's fun to be like, hey, what's a musical take that, you know, everyone probably agrees with, hey, music is good and it's great that we can listen to a lot of it.
What is a take that no one will agree with us on?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And I think for me, the big takeaway, and this brings me back to one of my favorite things to say, is that it's just being intentional with how you engage with art and how you engage with music. And you know, if you're constantly walking around with your iPod listening to whatever happens to be on, and you're interested in other options, consider maybe spending a week not doing that.
Yes.
You know, consider spending some time doing, and maybe like listening to one album a day or whatever, or a week or whatever, and just like very consciously picking out like, what is today's music? You don't have to. This is not an instruction. I'm not giving you homework. But like, if that sounds like an interesting experiment, maybe it'll change your relationship to music a bit, and maybe it'll change it in ways that you appreciate.
I think this is sort of one of the things that it sort of just came to me after we've been talking about this for an hour. But I think one of the things that I'm trying to express here is that kind of paradoxically, not listening to music can be a method of engaging with music.
Yeah.
Right? I think taking breaks in listening. And I mean, I think one of the other big things for me too, this is a change that happened like a couple of years ago, but I used to listen to music when I walked everywhere. I used to listen to music when I biked places. I used to listen to music when I skied. I used to have music in all the time. And I sort of stopped that, and I've just really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed just walking and not being as stimulated, which has nothing to do with really what we're talking about here. I guess what I'm saying is touch grass. But I think I have enjoyed it. And I think going forward, now that I'm back home, I am actually going to try to take some time and listen to less music, not because I think that I've been listening to too much, or not because I don't want to enrich my experience with music, but
because music is bad.
Yes, exactly. But specifically because I think that not listening to music and being intentional about listening to music and being intentional about not listening to music will change the way, you know, it'll change my experience of music. And I'm always looking to find new ways to change my experience of music.
Yeah. Yeah. And to draw like a terrible analogy that falls apart under even the lightest amount of scrutiny, it's kind of like a tolerance break. Where, you know, not that this is something that I have any personal experience with.
Me neither. Certainly not.
In the world of drug culture, this is a thing where, like, if you do the same drug over and over forever, you build up a tolerance and it stops having the same effect. And so taking breaks to let your body lose its tolerance and get back makes that experience arguably, and this is not advice for how to do drugs. It's important to note, 12 Tone is not telling you how to do drugs here.
If you want that, you need to subscribe to the Patreon.
Yeah. No, if you want that, you need to listen to Noah. But in a way, like what you're doing is you're taking the stimulus that you're very used to receiving and has become a very mundane part of your life and letting that mundanity sort of dissolve a bit, letting it become special again in a way that like it has been in the past. And again, I want to be clear, like I don't think that it becomes unspecial. I don't think that you can't have meaningful experiences listening to music if you're listening to music all the time. I don't think that's what either of us are saying. But again, this is one of those things, like, as a thing to try, if you're interested, maybe try again giving yourself a musical tolerance break, giving yourself some time to not engage, and then, you know, when you come back to it, seeing how that's different, seeing how that, if that feels different, and maybe it doesn't, maybe it has no real effect on you, like that's fine, but maybe it does. Maybe you wind up coming back and looking and being like, oh, you know what I really want to listen to is this album I haven't listened to in 10 years. But giving yourself that space reminds you of how meaningful that was and lets you reconnect, and maybe that experience does something for you. I don't know.
I think on a level too, I don't think it needs to be don't listen to music, but, you know, from a creative perspective, I am always a believer in, you know, limitations breed creativity. And I think that there's a truth to limitations helping you engage with creativity as well. So it could be a thing like I'm considering maybe trying to see what it's like if I go a month only listening to music on physical media, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe I'll just say, pick one day a week and say Tuesdays, I don't listen to music, you know, or only listening to music live or something like that. Like, I think to be clear, I mean, it would be an interesting experiment to cut music out entirely
yeah.
for a time, but I don't think it would be very feasible. And really, I don't think I would enjoy it because I still love music a lot.
There's music in public places yes. a lot. You can't get away from that.
Yeah. But I think when there are limitations placed on creativity, exciting things happen. And I think that there's a truth to that, whether you are creating or whether you are consuming other people's yeah. creativity.
Yeah. Yeah. You can also, like, in addition to, like, physical limitations like that, you can just make up yes. random rules. Like, you can decide you're only listening to bands' third albums for a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just try and figure out, like, for bands, like, is this their third album? You have to decide how you're handling EPs versus LPs.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff you have to consider. But then you're going and maybe there's a band whose first couple albums you really love, but you've never listened to their third album or whatever. I'm using this as a toy example. That it doesn't have to be that at all. But you can listen to only songs that start with a specific letter. You can do, like,
yeah.
these are similar sort of ways to break the mundanity of it, to step back and make decisions and force yourself to make decisions, because that's a lot of it is human beings don't really like making decisions naturally. Yeah. That's why a lot of recommendation algorithms are so effective, is that they take that responsibility away, but they also take that option away. But also making decisions is cool and good, especially in the world of art. None of this is you have to, none of this is homework. But, like, finding ways to make yourself be more conscious about the music you're picking. And again, I know I come back to this at the end of, like, every Ghost Notes episode. I'm a broken record. But it's also true. Like, it's also good. And I think that it's a thing that a lot of people don't necessarily do. And to an extent, that's new. But to an extent, it isn't, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, as long as there's been radio, there's been people listening to music without yep. making choices about what music they're going to listen to. And also significantly before then. As long as yes. there's been troubadours, that's been a thing.
And I think one thing, if you are sort of doing these experiments at all, one thing that's really stuck in my mind from sort of semi-intentionally doing this is just take note of what songs you really, really want to listen to. You know, yeah. 'cause that was something for me where I was like, you know, if I really, really wanted to listen to a song, I did have my phone and computer and I would yeah. put it on. And it's just interesting to see. Not for, like, any reason other than it's neat to play around in your own mind and see when you strip yourself of the freedom to listen to any music, what music does your mind really start to yearn for?
Yeah.
It's just a cool thought experiment. That's all.
Yeah. Like, again, I think a lot of this for me, it's not about the volume.
Yeah.
I was going to say the volume of the music, that means something different. But, you know, it's not about how much music you're listening to. It's just, really, what it is endpoints, natural endpoints. I think that it is better. Better is a strong word. I'm not going to say better. I prefer to engage with music, and I think that it is easier to engage with music more deeply if you are doing it in a way that has natural endpoints, because those force you to ask, do I want to continue? And what do I want to do next?
Yes.
And I think that if you put your entire iPod on shuffle, or if you just do Spotify, whatever.
Corey, nobody has iPods anymore. It's 2024.
Well, but I'm like in my 30s, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you put your music library on shuffle, if you do like Spotify, random, whatever they do, I don't use Spotify. If you use Spotify, you know what feature I'm talking about and you know what it's called.
Yeah.
But those sorts of things where it will just autoplay forever, then you aren't getting those opportunities to ask what you want from the music. And that's,
yeah.
I think, in as much as I feel like something has been lost, that's the thing I feel has been lost. And again, I want to be really careful about saying things have been lost because a lot has been gained too. But that is something that I am very careful about in the way that I engage with music. Like I said, I mostly will just put on an album because that's, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. And then at that point, I'm going to have to decide if I want to keep listening to music and if I do, what album I want to put on next. And I think that that encourages me to listen more closely and more carefully to what I am listening to. And again, none of this is homework. None of this is mandatory. Listen to music however you want. That's something that I find very useful in my like listening to music as a way to continue engaging deeply and interestedly.
Yeah. I don't have much to add to that. I agree with what Corey said. And this is why we listen to too much music.
Yep.
Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. Yeah, no, I think that's a really nice way of putting it. It's just intentionality in all things, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's always like, as a little extra caveat to my caveat to my caveat, like I said earlier, there's a lot of value in naive listening. There's a lot of value in shallow listening. Like, this is not to say that this has to be the only way you engage with music. It's just a way that I find more rewarding when my goal is specifically to listen to music. But like, when I'm driving, I put on the radio and I will listen to whatever they're playing.
Yeah.
And I'll have a good time with it. And I think that that serves the purpose that I need there. I don't want to be like constantly making new decisions while I'm driving, because I'm driving.
Yeah.
I have other things to focus on.
Yeah.
So that's a thing I want to be clear about too, is like, this is not to say that if you're not doing that, you're bad at music listening.
Yeah.
I've said this so many times. That's just not a thing.
Yeah. We're too apologetic, Corey.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
With that apology, I think we've beaten this dead horse long enough. Let's let it go.
Yeah. Sorry, horse.
All right. Bye. All right.
Okay, bye.